Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe.
I'm Heather Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a fantastic guest lined up for you. And that is Sandy Gordon, a sports psychologist who now works for Performance Perspectives International. And we've had Sandy on before, but I finally got him, a sports psychologist, to talk about mental health, John, in sport, because
excellent.
So many refuse to talk to me about it. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
Good to be back. And yeah,
it
John,
is.
Seriously, I've spoken to so many sports psychologists and said, will you come on and talk about mental health? And they went, no. None of them were prepared to stick their head above the parapet. So utmost respect for Sandy because he was prepared to.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was a time when Sandy was just as famous as the athletes he was dealing with, the Australian cricket team at one stage, among others. And it should be a good interview, Ashley.
Well, no, I always love catching up with him. I just wish I'd met him when I was a teenager because I think I would have learnt a lot. I still do, actually, every meeting I have with him. Anyway, am I starting us off?
You are. Your turn.
Okay, well, since we last spoke, I think you would have been very happy. I know we spoke off air that the International Athletics Federation, or World Athletics as they're known today, announced that they were going to have a prize pot of $2.4 million at the Olympic Games, and they're going to give gold medalists $50,000, and it is going to go down from that if you also win a silver or a bronze. And we said for a long time that the Olympic Games need to start offering prize money. The medal is not enough because it doesn't guarantee you riches after your career is over. And I think it's fantastic that Lord Coe has made this decision. And one of his quotes said, if I thought athletes were only competing because there was a financial pot at the end of the day, then I might have taken a very different view, but they are not.
No. I wouldn't think so. Well, considering there's not been any money in it anyway, beforehand.
Exactly. So, but I think it's really good. And I mean, people are saying there's some people, there was a Australian sports broadcaster who came out trying to claim that athletes get enough reward if they win a gold medal. Well, they do in Australia. They get a gift from the government, but they won't make, there's only a very, very few will make money from sporting endorsements these days. And if you talk to, and I have spoken to quite a few medalists, they go, it means absolutely nothing when your career is over.
Well, just having a gold medal in your pocket doesn't make you attractive to sponsors and marketing people. Because they're looking for something else. They're not there, you know what I mean? You've got to have a certain sort of personality, you've got to have a cut through with Democrat, you know, it's not just having the gold medal in your pocket that makes you attractive to a sponsor.
Now, the interesting thing is the reaction of the other sporting federations and the IOC. They are fuming that World Athletics has done this because it now puts the spotlight on them. And to me, this was the crucial thing when World Athletics made their announcement. So listen to this. So it was between 2017 and 2021, the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, made $7.6 billion in revenues from the Olympic Games.
In a four-year period.
Yep. Now, the IOC, to be fair...
During COVID.
Yep. redistributes 90% of that money.
Okay.
Right? So still 10% of $7.6 billion, still a lot of money. Anyway, they redistribute 90% of that income. And that goes to the National Olympic Committees and it goes to the International Federations. So what that means is that every day the equivalent of 4.2 million goes to help athletes and sports organizations at all levels around the world. Now the big question everyone needs to be asking, if they can turn around and say we're going to give this amount of money, which is 2.4 million is what World Athletics have allocated, why can't some of the other sports give prize money for their events, even outside of the Olympics?
Yeah, and prize money is problematic to an event like the Olympics, given that $50,000 to an Australian or an American athlete isn't what $50,000 is to a Ghanaian athlete.
No.
And it's further complicated by the fact now that the world is such a global thing. A lot of these countries that you might think are third world or second world or whatever, you know, lesser socio-economic powered or whatever.
Second tier nations or,
whatever you want to use. A lot of the athletes from those countries that do go to the Olympics aren't living in those countries anymore. It's not like the old days where some guy just comes out of Kenya and no one's ever heard of him.
Yeah, they're all at American universities
They're all overseas studying, they're on scholarships or whatever they're doing. Now that doesn't, so it becomes problematic for these organisations to go, oh look, here's 50 grand because 50 grand is not equal to all of them, if you know what I mean.
I do.
But it's a really good start. It's at least someone is recognising it. That they do deserve to be rewarded.
Well, the crucial thing, I think, when you look at it, is why do we tune into the Olympic Games? We tune in to see the athletes. That's the only reason. We tune in to see them performing in their event. And if they're walking away and all they're being given is a gold medal and a free trip to Paris for 2 weeks, it's not much, really, for four, and in some cases, 8 years' work.
And we know that the whole, as we said, the whole, oh, I've got an Olympic medal, my life is set, is a load of rubbish. It's not true.
Yeah, not anymore. I mean, even in America, it was interesting. I was reading something, I think it was after the Tokyo Olympic Games, and it was talking about the American athletes that won gold following Tokyo. And it said that now, whereas before they reckoned you could make money for probably 2 to 3 years that your brand would be in a really strong position and you could be on a Wheaties box and whatever, it was saying it's far less now because the world changes so much quickly and trends change so much quickly. And they said, literally, unless you've got something lined up before you win the gold medal, you're less likely to reap the benefits. And it was saying that then you only have a period of 8 to 9 months in which to reap the rewards, because beyond a year, you're yesterday's news.
Name me the Australian gold medalist at the last Olympics.
I couldn't do it, yeah.
And that's what the Olympics...
We didn't win many, did we?
No. But that's the truth of the Olympics. That was a
great winning edge program.
Yeah, it's such a fleeting thing for the rest of the country. Yeah, 2 weeks, Olympics, rah, rah, oh, isn't it Aussie good and all that sort of stuff and beat the drum. And it's gone within a week. It just disappears because people carry on with their lives. You know?
Yep.
So be it.
No, but look, I think it's great that World Athletics have done it. I do worry for the future of the Olympic Games. As we touched on the last podcast, I'm not sure how much longer it's got. I think we will see LA and Brisbane. Oh, sorry, the Gold Coast or where? No, it is Brisbane. Yep, I'm not sure.
So between 2017 and 2021, the IOC made 7.6
billion.
How much did Tokyo lose?
I believe that was 20 billion or something, or 20 million. Certainly it was a huge figure.
They lost.
Yeah.
After hosting the Olympics.
They made no money at all.
Don't you reckon it should be on the Olympics to at least stump up to make it cut even? Look, you've built us all these facilities. You provided all this sort of stuff.
Well, it wouldn't be so bad if they actually paid tax in the countries that were hosting the games. That would make a big difference.
It would. And it would give those countries an opportunity to recoup the costs for doing the IOC's dirty work.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, maybe what the IOC needs to do is build a specialist facility off their own back and just hold the Olympic Games there every 4 years.
But everyone's been talking about that for how long?
And where would
they put it? That's the big answer. I mean, they said they were going to put it in Greece, but you really can't when you look at what the stadium that they built for the 2004 Olympics now is just, it's a shambles.
When you think about the globe, let's see, I've got one up there, I can see it. Well, it would be a nice central place where the whole world would be equidistant from it sort of thing, you know.
The Middle East.
Yeah, I was thinking Kazakhstan. Somewhere like that. We could base the IOC there.
Borat, isn't he from Kazakhstan?
He is. Be a great ambassador.
Oh, what an ambassador.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
as I mentioned at the top of the show, I've been trying to get some sports psychologist on this show to talk about how mental health is a phrase that's bandied about a lot more than it used to in sport. And a lot of people refuse to come on the show and talk to us about it. But I'm very pleased to say that our next guest is someone we've had on the show before, and he was more than happy to come on and talk about this very prickly issue. And our guest is Sandy Gordon. Sandy Gordon, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here, Ashley.
Well, it's been a while since we caught up, and I really do appreciate you having a chat about mental health. And I think the first question I was going to ask you is, can you define mental health? I mean, I would think that would be very difficult.
Yeah, compared to mental illness, which you can describe, in fact, there's a series of criteria that to define each psychopathological state. Mental health is a little bit broader in scope. And so it's typically wound up in mental well-being. And so, but it is separate from mental illness. Mental illness is a different concept to deal with and to treat.
We hear a lot of athletes today are suffering from mental health issues. Sometimes I must admit I'm a bit cynical probably and think that they're using that term to mask other issues, like maybe the use of recreational drugs. I mean, do you think that's really a dangerous thing to do?
Absolutely. It's a sign that there's a coping situation there. It's not quite meeting the pressures of the life that they've chosen and being able to sustain it. The pressures are there to stay current, to stay selected, to be eligible, to because that lifestyle, however long it is, usually quite brief, is earns a lot of money and sets careers up for life beyond their activity, but at an expense that some people do regret, and not just for their own well-being, but the well-being of their support crew, immediate family. So I think it's often mentioned in newspapers and in passing by athletes because people are now more aware of it. I'm not sure if there's more of it in actual fact, but as if it never was present previously. But certainly people are sensitized now to it and rightly or wrongly are seeking support, which they are getting inconsistently, but it's there.
The other one is, you know, obviously now there's a lot of things that are, dare I say, classified or described as mental health issues, but they appear to some of us who aren't in the sporting field that they're really just everyday events, and then they're things that happen in life.
Yeah, that's right. They're life events and daily hassles. I mean, these are the top criteria that set you on the pathway to anxiety issues or depression issues, and it's courtesy of just having a busy schedule. You know, how do you juggle so many balls? Or how many balls have you got to juggle for a start? But once you've got them, how do you juggle them and keep them in play? And so a large component of mental health struggles is a function of time management or lack of it, and the ability to compartmentalize your sport with your personal life, with your social life, and so forth. So that's where people need assistance on occasion because it's not immediately available. You know, it's not naturally ingrained. It's, I've got so much on my plate. And so you end up with so many things to obsess about and told to think important enough of that you get feelings of being overwhelmed. And so that's where it's coming from. It's leading busy lives, but it's very short and sharp. And because I think, I'm not sure, professional athletes do a lot of nothing, you know, and in between training and games. And so an idle brain's a devil's workshop. And so there's the problem.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you say about time management, because I consider that when you look at a lot of the young age now, we're introducing children to what we class as an elite pathway.
and yet they have to juggle schoolwork and trying to be an elite athlete and all of this. And I'll bet you nobody's actually talking to them about that particular side of things.
No, we try to. I mean, sports psychologists do, certainly, and the player welfare people do help introduce a structure when there isn't any. And helping them manage that. And we have diaries now. We encourage journaling, you know, for people to plan their day and making sure that when they're here and not over there and so forth. So I see plenty of young athletes who benefit hugely from that type of structure being introduced formally as opposed to learning it by happen chance, you know. So the time management issue, the busy lives that people have, and particularly in this now world of social media attractions, is a real struggle for a lot of athletes.
The one thing I am concerned about is we're seeing, as I said, these pathways. So we're introducing children at a very young age, I think too young, to what they're sold, I suppose, a dream that if they get on this pathway, they're going to make it. When, as you touched on there, some of them might, but it might not be for very long. But the majority won't make it.
Yeah.
And yet they're sold this dream. And then when they're told it's over, before they've even got to the professional ranks, some of them are really struggling.
Yeah, there is a concept called athletic identity. And building an athlete's identity around sport exclusively, having them foreclose exclusively on being an athlete. I'm Ashley the athlete. Pleased to meet you, you know.
Yeah.
That is okay to a point, but as you say, if the athlete's not there, maybe you get injured or you get deselected or you get old. who are you? You know, so that loss of identity is a real issue for people to deal with. And unless they've been developed with other things going on, concomitantly with their sport, they're always going to have that athletic identity as the dominant force for living, the purpose in life. So the key is always to help encourage or to encourage athletes to have an education as well as their sport, for example. I mean, the healthiest way to develop that is through scholarships and things, and I actively support parents who are interested in, you know, overseas scholarships, so that people come out with a degree as well as having played very good level sport, but they've got a degree in something, so they come back to Australia, or they stay in Australia, but they have another aspect of their life that is being developed at the same time as the sporting aspect of their life.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not just young athletes that are like that, because if you look how many boxers just cannot cope when they get out and retire from the ring and make comebacks, and there are other athletes that have tried the comeback because they miss that roar of the crowd and the buzz, and they actually don't have anything else once they finish.
No, it's difficult to substitute, isn't it? I mean, that rush and trying to find whatever that is very often leads to embarrassment and more disappointment and reflection on and regret that they hadn't developed another aspect of their life in addition to the sport one. There's a lot of sad comeback stories that haven't worked.
When we were talking before teeing up this interview, you said that maybe there needs to be, in some cases, a shift from striving for winning, between winning and excellence. Like you were saying, young athletes, we should be telling them to strive for excellence over winning. I mean, can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, sure. A lot of this comes from the work that Carol Dweck has conducted in the area of growth and fixed mindset. The growth mindset is the positive, controllable pursuit of excellence, pursuit of improvement type of approach to sport and developing yourself as an athlete. The alternative is the fixed mindset, which is exclusively very much ego-oriented. It's beating somebody and beating other people or beating other teams. But at the expense of a perspective that is unhealthy. So having your life revolve around winning all the time, and this could be at training as well, as in fairly highly competitive training environments. These are environments that are not very healthy for lesser skilled people who need to be allowed to, given permission to fail in order to learn. So the pursuit of excellence is what Stoics would say, something you've got control over. Pursuit of success is something that you don't have control over, because there's other people playing against you who've got some idea of what they want to do. So I think the environments that the young athletes grow up in can be engineered to the extent by coaches who are aware of this research, to present motivational climates at their clubs that are inherently safe to fail. They're secure. So people will likely learn and they'll keep improving, getting better than they were yesterday, every day. You know, that is something that appeals to people as a mentally healthy approach to sport, in contrast to got to beat so and so, got to have a PB, I've got to do this by this time, got to get this, you know, prisoners of measure time, you know, we're up against the clock, when in actual fact what you're wanting them to do is continue to try and get better. And so athletes relate to that. When you have a climate that is exclusively focused on winning and beating other people, that is very threatening, and it's hard to sustain, and learning's impossible, because all your focus is on being better than that person. And we know that you can play terribly and win, you know. Yeah. But I think you're right. Earlier on, you mentioned the competitive ages is getting earlier and earlier. This is a real issue. There's a number of one book in particular that's come out. A colleague of mine in Singapore put it together called Good Sport, and Jaylee Nair is her name, and an excellent book for parents, because it helps you. Have conversations that are nurturing before a competition, during it, and after it, in line with this growth mindset perspective that Carl Dweck came up with several years ago.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing I think as well, when you're talking about that, about striving for excellence over winning, we then also have an issue, because government funding is based on winning. And so you could turn it around and say, well, government funding is actually detrimental to our athletes' health because they're putting that much pressure. I mean, it's a difficult one.
It is difficult. And you know, there are structures here at Worcester-Stroyan Institute of Sport and other institutes of sport that are only funded if they've got a chance of meddling.
Yeah.
You know, these are podium programs.
So I don't agree with that.
What do the other athletes think? Well, what are we? We're not important enough, and so you're right. It is an issue that governments are, probably indirectly, but in some cases directly, perpetuating the idea that only winning is important, when it's not. I mean, if you look at participation numbers, motives for participation. I mean, research has been tracking this all the time. It hasn't changed. Kids start to play sport because they love to have fun and they want to be with their mates and make new mates and they want to learn skills. Why do they drop out? Because they're not having fun. They've lost all the things that they valued, and value is a very big issue here. They get caught in the treadmill, like rats in a training wheel, supports an unhealthy perspective on what sport is capable of doing, which is beyond just winning. Of course, if you pursue excellence, winning will look after itself.
Yeah.
You know, so that's something apparently is difficult to sell to some people. And some traditional old school coaches as well.
Yeah, I mean, I have a problem with the young age that we're introducing these children, because we are seeing them. The statistics are there that they are dropping out when they are dropped out of the program. And I don't see the reason for it. I mean, there's famous quotes from Arsene Wenger saying, you show me a kid at 12 who's going to play in the Premier League when he's an adult and I'll give you £1 million. He goes, because you cannot guarantee that.
So, the talent ID programs have had various success. I mean, I don't think they've come up with anything conclusive there. Talent and giftedness, you know, are never enough. You know, those things are at the bottom of a staircase. The next step is huge work ethic. The next step is health habits. The next step is simulating, you know, competitive stress. And then you have on top of all these things the mental toughness that's required to be successful. A lot of people, kids and their parents believe this. Oh, my son is so talented. It's the worst thing they could say to a kid. You're so good. You're so gifted. And I'm so proud of you. And I'm a better parent because you're so good at this. It's a shame. And it's an alarm bell should go off every time that word is used or abused that way. Because it is not predictive. And I think the academies of sport that young players get into are very often to blame because their emphasis on that competitive motivational climate rubs out the intrinsic desire to play the game. People just stop having fun. I see heaps of players who are very, very talented 12 years, 13, 2 years later, they're not even playing the game.
Yeah.
Because that passion and desire to acquire the motives that they set out initially for participation in their chosen sport have been removed.
Absolutely. Well, I suppose we've got to wrap up soon. I could talk to you forever. I always enjoy it. But I'm just thinking, I mean, you've been around sport and the sort of mental side of things a long time. Are we seeing more people putting down issues to mental health? Has it changed in your time?
Well, I think it has, but it's been reported more because people are more sensitized to it. So that's a good thing on one hand. On the other hand, if it's due to this competitive ego-oriented motivational climate that we think is appropriate for younger athletes in particular, then it's really unhealthy. It needs to be addressed. At the professional level, well, you get what you get there. They've made their choices. They're going to go and play professionally. But what we're now seeing is player unions coming up with, we demand from our sport the athlete management systems. So we have player welfare programs. It's come from the players. It's not coming from the sport organizations. Sport organizations are supporting the player unions in this, but it's tail wagging the dog, I think, here. So I'm quite happy with what's being developed as a result of what players are reporting as a concern to them, including career transitioning, you know, retirement.
Yeah,
from
I think
sport.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah, that is good. And so the idea that players cannot do nothing anymore after training and after games, they need to be either earning or learning. So they've got a job or they're a student of something. So that at the end of their career, they will have something, experience if not a degree, to fall back on once their net playing days are finished. So interesting times for sure.
Sure are. Sandy, always good catching up with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Nice to chat.
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was Sandy Gordon, the sports psychologist, and again, brilliant to catch up with him. And I mean, the one thing I took from that, John, out of everything, is how we have to change the emphasis from being on winning to being on individuals striving for excellence and how that could change everything. And it was pleasing to hear that Sandy was saying that the junior pathways, getting these kids in so young is really detrimental, and that we're stopping children from doing what they do naturally, which is going out and playing with their mates and enjoying playing. And he was saying how so many people he talks to, you know, they, by the time they've hit 16, 17, they're no longer enjoying the sport they play because they've basically been coached out of that enjoyment.
Yeah, really interesting points you made. I've been doing some ground controlling down at the local club for juniors on, in the morning, Saturday, Sunday mornings, and just observing what goes on there and the behaviour of some parents. Okay, we know that's a bit of an issue. But there's a number of coaches I've seen where I think, are you doing this for the kids, mate, or is this about you? I get the feeling that there's a lot of coaches out there that it's massaging their ego. It ain't about the kids at all.
Well, I was reading something about exactly that in football, you know, the world game, and it was saying that they believed that this is definitely the case. It's all about the coaches and their self-promotion, their own personal benefits to get further up the ladder. And they were saying the thing that they think that has actually contributed to this, and that you're getting people who've actually never really played the game to any level trying to get into coaching now. People that, you know, some of them haven't even played, you know, for a club at first team level, but they played at school, but they like football, is they were saying it's the computer games. That they said EA Sports, they're playing that, or FIFA on the TV, on the GameStage console. And they were saying because they're managing players there, they think that they can manage players in real life.
The super coach. These super coach competitions, and you hear people talking, they go, oh, I've got this and I did this and oh, yeah, I could coach. No, you couldn't, mate. No, you could not. What you could do is sit there on a screen and make selections, but coaching is so much more than that. You know, it's quite frustrating to see the proliferation of these competitions, because that's what they are. They're competitions to make money. They charge you for them, right? So, and now they're being taken within the sport themselves as being seriously. You are hearing commentators say, oh, well, they got, 25, super points on the super coaching thing. Yeah. You know, oh, they must have had a good game. No, they didn't.
Well, I think again, and I was talking to a friend of mine who's involved with his son's team, and he was going, oh, he had like scored one goal at the weekend and five assists. I said, but when we were growing up, no one gave a monkeys about an assist. Basically, it was a team game. Your job, if you were out wide, was to pass the ball to your teammate, and as long as he scored, that was what the team was all about. But now that we've got this, and again, that's come from the game.
Scoring chains. Scoring chains.
What's a scoring chain? I've not heard that one.
Well, it goes from the fullback to the halfback, comes back to the centre half, goes to the...
Oh, so that's a chain now, is it?
It's a scoring chain, my friend. Oh, yeah. Love that one. You mean teamwork?
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking
Passing.
About? Passing. Passing? You mean what you've been trained to do and what you're training to do is...
Look, surely at the end of the day, it is how you play individually and how you fit into the team and whether the team gets the outcome that they're trying to get.
The funny thing about those sort of scoring chains, they don't work the other way. They don't have defensive ups. You know, there's no category for that.
Nah, it's really, I mean, the other thing, as I say, John, and I kind of raised that in the interview with Sandy, and I think this is a major thing, and I think it shows how we have a real problem with not just the governance of sport, but the governance of, I suppose, in the country, in that it is clear that certain departments are not talking to each other. So when they're developing these pathways and all the sporting infrastructure, certain departments are not talking to each other, because we're now seeing the government allocating money for the mental health side of things because our athletes today can't cope, because, you know, suddenly everyday issues are deemed mental health issues. But the problem I see is, as I said in that interview, is the government is basing its funding on winning. So if you're basing your funding on winning, and then this pressure on the players is causing them to have mental health issues because of that, then you need to readjust the model that you have, that winning is not the best way to go. That, as Sandy says in that interview, it is about striving for excellence. And this is where we've got, I think, the people running sport have got it so wrong. The two funding models we have in Australia, winning, so results of your national team, and participation numbers. And we know that every sport lies about their participation numbers, purely to get the money that they want from the government. And if the government went in and said, justify those figures, they couldn't do it, a lot of them. And I mean, a prime example is when they built the new state football centre here in Western Australia.
Yep.
You know, they were saying that there were 240,000 people playing football in Australia, in Western Australia. I had a meeting with one of the government people and I said, so do you believe that figure? And they said, well, that's what we're being told. I said, well, okay, how come then Football West only has 42,000 registered players? You're actually giving all this money to a lesser percentage than the amount of people that are playing the sport. And this government MP suddenly sat there and went, oh, well, yeah, I see what you're saying. I said, well, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, I think back to the great, inverted commas, might have an E on the end, it might not, Shane Warne. Now, he was renowned, and whenever people talk about what was one of the great strengths of Shane Warne, it was to cast everything aside and concentrate on performance. It didn't matter what turmoil was going on in his life at the time. He managed to get over that and perform. In fact, a lot of people said it was his escape, because all his troubles going, I'm just going out in the cricket field and I'll lose myself on the cricket field and I can just do that. Maybe it's I'm not sure exactly what I'm trying to say, but you know, we've got to teach athletes to turn off when they go onto a field. That this is your, and that's what sport.
Well, I think they need to turn on and turn off when they come off the field.
That's what sport was all about originally.
Yeah.
Was for people to get away from that mundane factory life that they were living 6 days a week, and on that day you can drop everything and forget about it, and you become a footballer, or you're a rugby player, or you're a cricketer, or whatever you do.
Yeah.
And now we've turned that around, because sport is now your job, and you are going to carry all the pressures of it being your job onto your performance in the field, the same way you would carry those pressures of being a brake mechanic into your everyday brake mechanicking. So we've actually lost what was so good about sport in the first place.
Yeah, and I mean, the sad thing I find is we've just lost the characters. We've lost the people that you actually paid to go and watch. And also, our modern day coaches have coached individualism out of the game. Only in the rarest cases do you see a coach giving a player free rein to do what they want. Now, they're not allowed to, if they see an opportunity to back themselves, they're not allowed to do that. And that I find is so sad, because it's those moments of brilliance by an individual that live with you for the rest of your life. If you were there and you witnessed it, you know, the amount of people that talk about Barry Richards' innings here in Perth, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know,
and there were hardly anybody there, as he said. If the amount of people that were at the Wacker that day, he goes, the amount that claim they're there is about 10 times as many that were there.
Oh, that's what they say about things like Woodstock too, isn't it?
Yeah.
and in some ways, this intense training of coaches within a mandated framework means that there's suddenly no longer that freedom of even coaches to be expressive.
Like, oh, not now. You can't even say what you think after a game.
Yeah. Oh, that's another story. But coaches all go through the same academy courses. They're all taught the same things. They're all taught not to do the same things. And suddenly there's no character within coaching anymore, because you've got to fit into this paradigm of what a coach is. And, you know, you've got to do this and X, Y, Z. You can't. If you came in as a coach and just went, I'm going to just delegate the running to that bloke, I'm going to delegate the skills to that bloke, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sit there on a Saturday afternoon and I'm just going to put the best players in the best positions to ensure that our team is going to win. And that might be player X this week is playing at left half because he's really good against that opposition player. That goes out the window. Now they just rotate guys. Predetermined rotations.
Yeah.
And live with that. They don't actually do that much coaching anymore.
But this is the thing. I mean, this is where good coaching is. You can only work with the talent you have. So therefore you have to adapt the way you play to the personnel that you have, just as you have to do in a business. But the interesting thing, John, and a lot of people don't realize this, do you know where coaching courses originated, how they started?
No.
Okay, so this was actually, and it was football was one of the first sports to start doing coaching courses, and we're going back to the 1950s. And what it was there was various coaches were playing the game, and I think it was Sir Walter Winterbottom just thought, we need to just have a sharing of ideas because everybody's doing things differently and we may learn from each other. So that was the idea. The whole point of the original first coaching course was to get a group of coaches together and share ideas, experiences and whatever that may help all of them become better coaches by sharing experiences and that knowledge. But boy, has it evolved from that.
Oh, yeah.
And not for the best, in my opinion.
And now we sucker parents into it. You know, you've got to have done a whatever grade level coaching course. You can't just come down and help your kid anymore.
But the minute you do that now, what do the parents want? They want paying. Because they've done a course. They're going, oh, I'm not doing it for free now.
Well, it's been interesting watching some of the junior teams. There's one particular club that we know pays junior coaches because they've got an outside helping hand within the structure of their club that gives them a lot more financial autonomy than a lot of other clubs do. You know, a lot of clubs struggle financially, but it's a rather big club, Green, you know who they are. And they have serious coaches for under 13s and stuff. You know, they're whiteboards and they're doing blah, blah, 40-minute warm-ups before games and stuff like this. Whereas other teams, it's someone's dad who's giving his time up and he's trying really hard and the inequity between in that is stark.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you another example. Another friend of mine whose child is playing. I'm not going to say what age. And the coach is getting paid $5,000 for the season. And they said literally at the end of the game, just never has a one-on-one with any of the kids. Just goes, well played, good effort today. See you all at training next week. That is it. They said they've been to four games this season. And that is all that has been said after every single game. And the player, who is only 13, has actually complained to their parents saying, I'm not learning anything with this guy. He doesn't tell us anything. He doesn't help us. He's not making my game get any better. At 13, they're aware of that.
And look, 13-year-olds are a lot more aware today than we were.
We were, absolutely.
We just ran around. We didn't care. Training was a laugh.
I didn't like losing.
No one likes losing. But it was a far more laissez-faire arrangement for most kids back then. They were doing it because they truly loved it. You know, you didn't go and do that sort of stuff. There was so much more you could be doing in this country.
Just to finish off, I will give you a story when I think I was 12 playing cricket and I was told to go out and play straight and I could win the game. And I remember I played the first two balls straight, swung across the line and got out. And our coach, literally as I walked off, he took my cap off my head, grabbed my hair, took me behind the pavilion, took my bat off my hand, went bend over and smacked me on the backside with my bat, probably about four times, and just said, next time, listen, didn't do what you're told. So, it made a massive difference. And I always say that was the turning point in my cricket playing when I realized that, yeah, you had to do things properly.
Oh, could you imagine trying to do that
today? Oh, today. Oh, he'd probably go to prison for it.
He would. No, he definitely would. That's scary. Hey, just a mental health thing. Because recently in a sport we don't talk about, we've seen some discussions about the players who test positive
to a random drug test. Yeah.
Random drug test, independent random drug test. Well, not even in, they're not random.
Yeah.
Independent in-club drug tests being given to players and then the doctor advising, the club doctors advising the player not to be picked so they wouldn't become under the scrutiny of WADA and the drug stuff. Now, that is a really dangerous, dangerous area. And
it shouldn't be happening. To me, the club doctor or people need to lose their jobs over that.
Thinking back over the past, say, just 2 years, there's now a huge question mark over a number of players with so-called mental health problems.
Yeah.
Or personal issues. And how many other sports is this happening in?
I think...
How often is the mental health thing being held up as a cover for just bad behaviour?
I think a lot. And that's what Sandy touched on as well, you know, in the interview. And I think, as he said in the interview, the problem you've got is these athletes have too much time on their hands. So now what they're trying to do is you must have a job or you must be studying in your downtime so that you're not just lazing around opening a can of beer or doing something worse.
How about clubs are only allowed a certain amount of access to players, regardless if you want to sign a guy for $200 million, you can do that, but he only has to turn up to 2 training sessions and 1 weight session a week plus game day. And that would, and that may force people to go out and do other things. They might just sit back and play PlayStation, in which case when their career ends, they'll be stuffed and that $200 million will disappear really quickly. They'll live such a lavish, you see it all, time in American football, guys have been on millions of dollars. 10 years later, they got nothing.
Yep.
Because they've never prepared themselves to do anything after it. And a lot of the time, it's not, oh, you've just wasted your money. It's you've continued to live a lifestyle.
Peer pressure, a lot of it.
Yeah, without going out, and you've got nothing to fill.
And the big problem with American football is, of course, they only get paid during the season. They don't get paid during the off season.
No.
Their payment only happens during the season. So the season finishes, bang, there's no more payments. So again, that's where a lot of them have said then when they get cut, they're in real trouble.
And they lead lifestyles that are unsustainable.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, the first thing that a lot of athletes do is go and buy a big car and a big house. And big houses come with big maintenance bills.
Yep.
And so maybe what the idea is, we don't pay athletes at all.
Well, go back to those days.
Yeah.
And they catch the bus to a game with all the fans.
Yep, that'd be good.
Yep.
I bet the level of performance wouldn't drop. I bet the level of excitement generated by them for the fans would not drop. They'd still...
No, wouldn't drop at all.
No.
And just finally, if there's anyone listening that lives in London, we have our documentary Return to Your Corner is screening on the 24th of May. At the West Norwood Picture House as part of the London International Pan-African Film Festival. Love to see you there. I know we do have listeners in the UK, but I shall be there doing the Q&A. So if you can get along, it would just be brilliant to see you there. If you know anyone that loves boxing or the African connection, again, let them know. And all of the details are actually on the Not the Footy Show Facebook page.
That's the award-winning, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Yes. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.